Welcome everyone to the very first Transformers podcast hosted by myself, Matt Neal. I'm one of the founding partners over at Tessient. We are a management consulting firm, primarily working within the consumer and retail industries. And really what we're trying to be famous for is a combination of talent from consulting and people who have worked in industry, who've sat big seats, who've taken companies through big change. And this Transformers podcast is all about speaking to some of those people from our network about some of the transformations they've been involved with. And today I'm joined by my co-host, Charlotte.
Hi, I'm Charlotte Gledhill, and my day job is running transformation programmes as part of the Tessient team. I've got a background in both industry and consulting, so that's part of the reason I'm here from what Matt just described.
Charlotte gets to ask the important questions, whereas I was a headhunter and I get to ask the stupid ones, I think, is the way this is going to go. And then we're joined today by Doug Nesbitt. Doug, would you like to intro yourself?
Yeah, so Doug Nesbitt. I've spent the last 20 years working in retail in strategy and transformation roles, and spent 5 years at Home Retail Group being strategy and transformation director, and so kind of heavily involved in Argos, and that's what we'll be talking about today. And still doing that now, so currently working at WH Smiths as Group Strategy Director.
Fantastic, great. Welcome. If we start by sort of setting a bit of a scene for the Argos story. So, I mean, I remember this because I was working as a headhunter in retail at the time, and sort of 2008 through to 2011, you saw Argos maintaining sales, but profit sort of really dropping, margin really dropping. I mean, the headlines, Argos profits slumped by 94%. Argos struggles to £3 million profit. Argos continues to drag down home retail. And I remember in the office that I worked in, we were talking about this potentially being another blockbuster. It got sideswiped by Amazon, right? Yeah. That's essentially what happened. At what point did you become involved in the Argos story and how you approached about it?
Yeah, just to put some context around that. So the Argos model had just been massively successful. And literally, the model was they knew for every page in the Argos catalogue how much money that would generate, and for a big box versus a small box. And so value creation each year was put some more pages into the Argos catalogue, generated more turnover, massively successful business. But then, as you say, kind of in the period before I joined, it had gone from making 400 million profit a year to 100 million of profit. And in the year that I joined, it was budgeted to only make 50 million. And once you're down to that level of profitability, you kind of, it becomes very questionable what's the long-term future of the business. They had had an MD of the Argos business that had kind of left, and so the CEO, Terry Duddy, had kind of stepped in and was acting as MD of the Argos business. And I guess I was a little bit, I met him. Terry Duddy is an absolute gentleman of UK retail, is a fabulous person. And so I went and had a chat with him, and my hour-long interview took 2 hours because kind of really clicked with him and really liked him. But I was still left a little bit surprised that their kind of relaxed thinking about what needs to be done with the Argos business. They were, we've got a new MD coming in to join. He was kind of working his way through a gardening period whilst I was kind of agreed to join them. But kind of when he comes in, we'll work out a strategy. And it just felt quite relaxed for a business that had this trajectory. And I agree with you, had this kind of external perception of, is this still going to be around in a few years' time?
I think that the whole of UK retail got completely blindsided by Amazon, though, right? Entry to the market. I can't remember whether it was a Curry CEO or a Dixon CEO who'd said something along the lines, oh, we're not worried about them because they won't be around in 5 years' time. They can't afford to keep selling at the prices they sell at. And, you know, how wrong that was.
Yeah. And even more recently, I was working at a health and wellness retailer, and the CEO, then we did some customer research, which highlighted Amazon as a big competitor in that space. And he the CEO totally dismissed that research because he just didn't believe it was true.
Really?
But it just was. And so even in categories where you don't think of Amazon as being a big player, even now, this is only 4 or 5 years ago, kind of we're still very quick to dismiss the impact Amazon has had on UK retail, even now when they're bigger than Tesco's. And
because they don't care about profit until they've dominated a market, do they? And that's what makes them so incredibly dangerous to incumbents, I think.
Yeah.
But the prior strategy for Argos, I mean, some of the things they were trying in that period from 2008, 2011, before you joined them, Argos TV,
yeah.
It was a JV in China.
I could take us off on a tangent now, but I have a wonderful little story about Argos TV where they had done the analysis on Argos TV and had worked out that for a product that was on Argos TV, they got 6 times the sales of the Argos TV sales lift in the store sales. And therefore, if you multiplied the tiny unprofitable sales by 6, you kind of just about got it to washing its own face.
Yeah.
But I drilled into the analysis they'd done. And their analysis was, if we've advertised the product on Argos TV last week, let's look at what's happened to the sales this week of those products across the store estate. Now, then if the sales have gone down, well, let's exclude that from the sample because it couldn't have driven a negative impact on sales. And if we look at the positive uplift and take an average of that, then we get 6 times the sales in the Argos TV. But it's just a totally flawed
skewed
logic. And it took me, I had an exec session where I was trying to explain this. And it was surprising how difficult it is to get people's heads around. They were kind of like, okay, so maybe it's not 6, it's 5 times. It's like, no, the logic is totally flawed. Perversely, in this scenario, the data I looked at, it technically, you claim it had a negative impact on sales just because of the random chance of it. But it was just quite an interesting...
So it's picking up all sorts of anomalies and things that were not actually caused by the TV situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. They were selling Kindle as well. They were doing Amazon a bit of a favour at that point as well, weren't they?
Yeah.
So you got the call.
Yeah.
How were they selling the job to you at that point? Because it was kind of been the most attractive of...
It was a kind of an interesting opportunity to get involved in clearly a turnaround opportunity. Yeah. I'd been at Dixon's before that, which again was a turnaround and had been exciting, but was possibly kind of maturing out of the kind of worst of its turnaround.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of an interesting time. But really what, as I said, what persuaded me was Terry was...
Yeah.
Just really inspiring. And there are lots of kind of macho, aggressive leaders in UK retail and far fewer gentlemen who are still capable of making tough calls and all that kind of stuff. And I thought Terry was an inspiring individual to work for because he was perfectly strong and good at making tough decisions and all that stuff, but always done as a gentleman rather than as an animal.
Fantastic. John Walden was the MD who was waiting to come in at that point. And I remember, again, being part of the UK sort of headhunting community. This was a guy who, I think he'd done 8 years at Best Buy, and then he'd done a year at Sears, and then he'd been out of the market for something like 4 years.
Mm.
So we were looking at that going, well, that's quite risky, isn't it? And at what point in the process did you meet John?
So having already accepted, I hadn't met him at that point.
Mm.
And so he then joined whilst I was still doing my gardening leave. So kind of whilst I was on gardening leave, I came in and met him and came across very well. But the most interesting thing was once I properly joined, this business that had seemed very laid back about, oh, we're worried about the Argos, kind of suddenly John had been there for all of 6 weeks by the time I joined. And it was like he'd put a bomb under the place. Everyone running around with their hair on fire. Right, we need to do this. We need to sort out the strategy. We need to work out what we're doing. Just was brilliant at generating that urgency around...
Energy
around change. And so from my biggest nervousness being, is this business up for the scale of change that we need to go on? Never a worry in my time there. He was trying to keep up with the boss. That was the challenge. Kind of worrying about persuading them that we need to drive some change.
And you had, I think I read somewhere that you had OC&C in as well at some point there.
Yeah. Well, so when I joined, we had OC&C in as strategy consultants. We had Accenture in doing a review of the IT from an IT perspective. We had Egremont coming in from a cultural change perspective. And then John had done this thing, which I've done multiple times since because it's brilliant, but just kind of involved the high-performing individuals across the business in taking out of their day job and put into kind of non-hierarchical, cross-functional teams to look at a specific element of the strategy and kind of, in a way, crowdsource the strategy. But in doing so, kind of a really great opportunity for everyone to think about the business strategically for once rather than in their little box. So everyone found it a really kind of exciting, energizing thing to have been involved in. But as a way of energizing everyone around the strategy and having everyone bought into it and believing in it and wanting to make it happen, brilliant in that respect as well. But you can imagine, so we've now, he's only been there 6 months. He's already got three different consultancies in. We've got about 90 high performers all involved in, and it's all a little bit out of control and a little bit scary. And I think a little bit of everybody waiting, kind of standing back and waiting for it to fall over so they can blame the consultants for having done a terrible job. And I kind of, rather than do that, I kind of waded in and thought, right, well, let's help the consultants. Let's try and make this as successful as we can be. And I think Terry Duddy had been away for a couple of weeks before and when I just first started, and already kind of had had such an impact in the 2 weeks of just trying to make sure this is all going to actually succeed rather than stand back and watch it fail. He was already pleased with what I'd done in my first 2 weeks. And from that point on, it was just getting on with it.
That's a huge thing in transformation, isn't it? And you see, it's the sort of thing, you sit in The Apprentice, nobody wants to get their hands dirty when it fails. And for that reason, people don't put themselves forward to make it succeed. Mm, yeah. So that's incredibly important to get right, I think.
Yeah.
So how did you get your arms around it then, Doug? So you talked about how you were walking into that relaxed at first, but then the bomb had been put up them. What were the first things that you went about doing?
Good question. Just embracing the process rather than kind of observing it. Mm-hmm. So almost a challenge of too much content being created, but that's great. Let's kind of listen to all the teams. Let's see what they've come up with. Also, let's understand what the consultants are coming up with, kind of efficiency, doing good work. So kind of what are they saying? What are they saying the opportunities are? Mm-hmm. But the biggest bit was trying to join the different bits together. And yeah. So the biggest thing was Accenture were coming up with lots of good, sensible recommendations about what needed to be done from a technology perspective, but not really able to articulate why that's important to the business. And then you've got the strategy kind of thinking and the teams, the internal teams, coming up with lots of great changes to the proposition and capabilities, but not quite understanding what technology is needed to underpin them. Mm. So almost the biggest thing was helping plug those two bits together such that you could kind of explain the technology plan in terms of business outcomes and benefits, or explain how we're going to deliver these business changes through the technology. And I think that helped everyone get to a much better sense. But also just a trying to pull stuff together from a customer's perspective. And so the other, it was only a couple of slides, but kind of just a really helpful couple of slides that tried to kind of take all this complexity, all this thinking, all this great stuff we were planning to do and what, into just a, here's what the customer experience is going to look like, or it looks like now with all the challenges that had, versus here's what the customer experience is going to look like in a couple of years' time. Mm. And suddenly that distilled out all this complexity into a simple, okay, we can see how that's going to really help.
Are there any nuggets from that customer vision that stick in your mind? Were there any ones that you'd call out that really had an impact?
So back to this kind of crowdsourced strategy approach, one of the nuggets that came out of that was, I think at the time we called it parent and child, but it was just the nugget of an idea that totally came from that rather than any of the consultants involved, which was, if we have large stores with lots of range in the back of them, but if we kind of set up a man in a van type operation that took that stock and got it to the nearby small stores, then we can offer this massive breadth of range from the small stores. And because Argos had already got everyone used to check and reserving, and so 50% of customers already told you that they were going to come to the store, you could get that full range from just a nearby local store, which was a great idea. Yes. But originally, when we came up with it, it was the concept was around reducing stock. But as we kind of played with that and thought it through, then you quite quickly got, rather than just reducing stock, actually you were driving significantly more sales from these nearby small stores. But then you realized, well, rather than just moving the stock to the nearby stores, you could also, and that man in the van can also be delivering it to home. And so this is what ended up being branded as Fast Track Home Delivery. But suddenly, sleepy old Argos, in the space of 2 years, we effectively created this same day home delivery capability that literally order a product at 12 o'clock on a Sunday lunch, and we'd get it delivered to you that evening for £2.99. And that was a honest price that covered our costs rather than we were taking a loss on.
Yeah.
And it was game-changing. We hadn't thought through all of that when we came up with the original idea, but what it turned into for a $4.1 billion turnover business, it was became 500 million of their sales went through that home delivery channel. And so just a massive thing to have created. And then the other dimension in which that nugget of an original idea went was, well, if I can get that much, if I can do that, then rather than needing a big store, you can become a much smaller store and still get away lots of sales. We had a Argos store and a retail park where we were losing that store and then opening another one 12 months later. And on that same retail park, we happened to have a home-based store, which was part of the same group. And so we set up a 1,000-square-foot Argos concession shop-in-shop inside the home base just to kind of manage that period.
Yes.
And that 1,000-square-foot Argos store took more money than the 40,000-square-foot home base that it was operating in, which just proved that, oh, because we can serve so much product from a tiny little space, the opportunity there.
Yeah.
And so I was involved in the conversations with Sainsbury's, where we ended up creating
the
partnership.
I was just thinking that, the forerunner.
And kind of, which kind of worked really well for us. You have these massive kind of high traffic intensity, lots of customers coming into a Sainsbury's store.
Yeah.
So from a really small space, we could drive a very successful, very profitable little Argos store. But that worked. What we hadn't clocked was that drove a load of new customers into the Sainsbury's stores.
Mm.
And so half of the customers coming into the Argos then bought some products from Sainsbury's.
Yeah.
And so that drove kind of like for like into the Sainsbury's store. And that was massively successful for them as well, which ultimately resulted in them buying the whole business.
And that strategy still competes with Amazon now, doesn't it? Because, you know, it's the immediacy of being able to go online, buy it, reserve it, pick it up within a couple of hours.
This was the irony of Argos. It was almost a business invented before its time.
Yeah.
It was holding all this stock in the stores, but not letting the customers touch or play with it, which kind of felt very strange to start with. But when you realised the amazing thing about Argos was it was the back of the stores was effectively a warehouse with kind of voice picking and voice control, which meant it had 99.9% accurate stock records. So a business invented for the digital age before anyone had worked out what the digital age was going to be.
So you've talked about how you were building the strategy, the crowdsourcing piece, listening to the consultants. How did you then boil that down into some sort of vision for the business? And what did that look like?
For a business that hadn't done much change, we did kind of battle with how do we get people excited about the transformation journey that we need to go on. And so I can remember we created a kind of a storyline of what it's going to be like to go through all this change and kind of the broader vision of the change we're going to go on and kind of engage everyone across the business to kind of get them excited about that. But there was an element of having had enough of, and certainly all the key individuals in the business already involved in creating the strategy, it wasn't that there was a big task of educating them so much. It was kind of there was a lot of that buying in already.
Yeah.
We brought in an old friend of mine who I'd previously worked with at OC&C and at Tesco's beforehand, but Andy Brown, to kind of be in the central ops team of the retail team, but did a wonderful job of engaging the store teams on all this change that's going to happen. And they did this wonderful, really engaging event where all of the store managers were involved in this kind of visualization of how's it going to work and what's that going to mean. But then clearly kind of recruiting a large number of van drivers that didn't exist before, all of that to be done in 2 years was very, very impressive. So there was lots of engagement of the retail teams where clearly a lot of the change was going to happen. We distilled the strategy down into kind of four pillars and then had steering group meetings and kind of organised ourselves a bit around that. And so that was helpful to kind of have a donut shape, kind of there was a wheel with the four elements of the strategy that kind of every time we talked about something, you could reference it back to those four pillars. And so that was helpful for everyone to kind of be able to understand and place where things happened in.
How did the store teams respond?
Everyone was aware that the business was challenged.
Yeah.
And therefore, I was taken aback at how positive and up for it everyone was.
Yeah.
Because we were driving massive change into the stores, but driving massive change from a technology perspective as well to enable a whole bunch of that. And we had Accenture supporting us on that technology journey. But John being John, the aggression with which we did that meant we delivered a huge amount, but also meant we broke a lot of things all along the way.
Yes.
And so
I was as normal.
Yeah. And so I was taken aback at how up for it the business was and keen to do it, even though that's not to pretend that it was easy or straightforward on the journey. But we, just to kind of give a sense of that, so we were negotiating a very large IT outsourcing and development contract with them. So that took us to maybe March of the following year. They were already starting to kind of build stuff before we'd develop stuff before we'd actually signed the formal contracts in April. And then the vision was that a year after we'd launched the strategy to the business, we were going to open 6 new digital stores, which required a bunch of systems to have been changed behind the scenes. So we kind of had a single view of stock and a sense of kind of where stuff was. But it was amazing to see how galvanizing it was. And so we opened the stores over a month late because of all the problems we'd had along the way.
Yeah.
And then
a month isn't too bad.
Yeah. And then we had lots of issues with them when they did open. And so there was then calls every morning and every afternoon as we were trying to kind of fix the issues with them and get them all working. We'd set up a mock shop halfway through that process as we were kind of designing the new look and feel and some brilliant third-party support as we were kind of coming up with the look of it. And just as an exec team, the first time we went to that mock shop, it was quite, wow, this is cool. This was inspiring. But then I remember the first time as an exec team, we walked into one of the concept stores.
Yes.
And that was just utterly breathtaking.
Was
and
it really?
That is a highlight of my retail career is just all of us looking at each other going, wow, have we actually
what
done this?
Created.
Yeah, yeah. And
how did customers respond to it?
Customers liked the look and feel. It was interesting that the impact on sales was never as profitable as we'd wanted or hoped it to be. One thing we didn't do right was recognize that there are a bunch of customers who love Argos to bits and who loved the old pens and bits of paper and theatre of dreams kind of experience. And so I think we energized and brought in a load of new customers into the store, but in being so aggressive around taking catalogs out of the store, kind of lost some of those loyal existing customers. And so ended up about flat. And it was interesting. We had to learn that. We still need to, it was probably right to have pushed the boundaries so much in those 6 concept stores. But as we started to do more stores, we learned that you had to bring kind of not alienate those loyal existing customers and make sure they could still look at a catalogue easily. And
ultimately, this ends up with the catalogue being discontinued, though, doesn't it, at some point? And what period did that happen? When did they...
It remained the case that for every catalogue that you could get into a customer's hand, you could pretty much, again, tell you how much value that catalogue was. And the value of getting a catalogue into the customer's hand was definitely coming down, but it still meant that it was profitable to get a catalogue into the customer's hand. And so we, print run was reducing anyway because customers were less interested in picking one up. And we kind of pushed the boundaries of that and worked hard on lots of thinking about, can you create a digital catalogue to kind of replace the physical one? And I think ultimately everyone's got so used to shopping digitally that that we've got there. And so more recently it did finally,
it just had
under Sainsbury's ownership, it closed it down. But
it
wasn't that you could, it was interesting that you can't force consumers to change their behaviour. You can encourage them to, you can come up with tools to make it easier for them to move. But if you'd just shut off the catalogue earlier, we would have just lost more money. It isn't that you can force them to change their behaviour ahead of it. One of the things digital still hasn't managed to pull off is the joyous serendipity of walking around a physical store, and I think in the same way, kind of being able to flick through an Argos catalogue and without knowing what you're looking for, being inspired and want and kind of going, oh, I want one of those. And I just don't think this, as an amazing business as Amazon is, hasn't captured that inspire me in the same easy way.
Do we think the technology is getting that way with metaverse and it's Apple's wearable, isn't it? That's the new thing, which is a goggle that you kind of wear and you kind of in somewhere and you can experience it more.
I think it's another one where you can't force the change faster than consumers are used to it. So every retailer, as we went into COVID, obviously partly because stores were physically shut, kind of everyone forced to go online. And so a massive spike in online penetration in retail. And everyone, myself definitely included in this, just assumed that this was going to be a step change. And even as we come out of lockdown, people will have educated consumers to shop online. And then what, and lots of digital retailers all struggling recently because everyone else made the same assumptions, over-invested in stock or systems or whatever capacity. Because what we saw was that digital penetration go back to the previous trend line. And so there wasn't any step change driven by COVID. And now that percentage of retail sales that are digital has gone back to its kind of previously growing. So not to say people are anti-digital, but just it was interesting that despite everyone being forced to shop digitally, once they were able to go back into shops, there's still a large contingent who wanted to go back into shops.
It's interesting. You're talking about the technology. So George Gailey came in to do technology, didn't he? And he is quite famous in the industry for being someone who is a tech evangelist who wants to sort of build everything from the ground up. How did that sort of slot into the jigsaw?
Just a little bit of context. So we're 3 years into the transformation journey, and Accenture doing amazing work, but just the pace of change, meaning we kept breaking stuff, every kind of taking down the website in the run-up to Christmas, 3 years in a row, and we kind of had the board say, if you take down the website next year, then this is going to be an issue. And so kind of that was around the time George had come in. But in that process, my role, I'd recently kind of gone from being focused on transformation to customer experience, because we'd realized we'd broken so many elements of the customer end-to-end customer journey that we literally created. I did a team that I led that owned the various different end-to-end journeys in the retail business to focus on how do we fix them? How do we fix all the broken bits? And so we just launched that at a big kind of leadership event. So my team was hosting one of the kind of breakout sessions in there. And kind of almost my first interaction with George was him coming up and saying, yeah, none of this should exist. This whole team is fundamentally flawed in its role or purpose. Which was quite an interesting opening interaction with George. And so we had lots of interesting debates of views because George believes you need people with technology. So he's agile evangelist, and so product managers owning elements of the proposition, and they should be the ones driving change with an intricate understanding of the technology required to drive that change as much as the business change. And so for me to have this end-to-end customer experience team kind of was overlapping with the roles he wanted to create.
Yes, that's what I was going to say. They were almost your product owners.
So you could have embraced them and said, I'll take those as product owners because of their understanding of the business. George clearly wanted to bring in people that kind of he understood the technology. And so there was plenty of clashing between us. But then the interesting story is, so I then went on to work at Holland & Barrett, and George came in as our CTO there. And despite all the kind of clashing of heads, kind of worked really well together at Holland & Barrett because I'm maybe not as much of an evangelist as George is, but I do believe that agile approach to delivering technology change is a much better way of doing it. Small, bite-sized chunks, testing and learning your way through it rather than pretending you know the answer. And
just building on that, one of the things we wanted to ask was if there was a particular approach you took with transformation. You've touched on some of it there with the agile piece. Are there any sort of factors that you go to each time in the different transformation roles that you've done that you want to try and bring to a program?
Yeah, I guess there's been lots of trendy concepts for anyone who's done change for a while knows, which is getting cross-functional teams of people together to work through a problem. And that doesn't sound as sexy. But it's just the reality of how to get good change delivered. So I like helping bring teams of people together to solve problems. And then I'm also a big believer in this, getting to the truth is how Terry Leahy used to describe it. And so I'm a big believer in using data to get to the truth. Not just data, kind of it's easy to boil the ocean, and particularly in retail. When I started in retail at Tesco's, it was an industry awash with data but very light on people who were able to analyze or understand that data. But if you almost kind of think of the challenge as more like investigative journalism, speak to the people, close to the customer, close to their operations, and get their input, because they will have the best working assumptions around what needs to be sorted. But then don't just rely on that. Then you need to go into the data and validate, and typically you'll prove that they're thinking is right, and so great, let's crack on and deliver it. But almost the most interesting times is when you prove that their thinking is wrong and actually something else is going on. And that's when you can drive the biggest, most transformational change. And so one of my claims to fame was I once went into a Tesco's supply chain operations group meeting and had done some analysis that showed that only, I won't get the numbers right, but 25% of the stock in the depot really needed to be there from a kind of fulfilling the customer's demand perspective. And 75% of it was just clogging up the depot.
Oh, really?
And and they had to, and the kind of supply chain director, Steve Garton, who was a very good guy, but just kind of, every so often you get presented with something which kind of slaps you around the face and you can't argue with. And it drove a whole bunch of activity around how do we make sure we kind of rein that in and kind of get more productivity out of the depots. But it was just interesting that kind of using that approach but validating stuff with data and getting into the detail of it kind of could drive massive change.
Tesco at that time was well known for its sort of challenging boardroom conversations. And anybody you speak to who's worked there really appreciates that it sounds combative, but a lot was achieved from that way of sort of, it feels like there was strong words, but things were left at the door and in a certain way. Has that influenced your sort of boardroom strategy going forward?
Certainly changed me from a boy to a man. I left consultant, 7 years in consultancy, OC&C. We had spent all this time creating large kind of 300-page documents.
Yes.
And I went into my first supply chain operations group meeting, kind of presenting whatever piece of change it was I'd been working on. And with a really slimmed down 12-page document, recognizing that they probably aren't interested in reading the big one. And as I walked in, I can't remember which one of the people around the table it was, but it was like, you expect me to read this? And kind of my slimmed down 30 page. And I kind of rapidly learned that it was all about building relationships with the individuals and giving them the chance to digest it before the meeting and all this kind of stuff. And it was just like, if only I'd understood all of this back in my consulting days, I could have...
You could have done a
done so much more.
Yeah, exactly.
We see a lot of consultancies that we work alongside sort of seem to think they get paid per slide, and then we end up having to try and boil that down to sort of, you know, five things to do really well rather than 550 pages of context.
It's kind of almost a shield, isn't it? It's kind of, well, if you're not agreeing with what I'm saying, well, at least I've produced lots of paperwork to prove it rather than actually focusing on what do we need to do here.
What matters.
Yeah.
So we asked on LinkedIn if there were any questions our followers would like us to ask. And one of the ones that came back was to find out what was achieved in the Argos transformation, but also conversely, what was not achieved that you might like to share.
And so with Argos, I think we kind of said the strategy was about reinventing Argos as a digital retail leader. And I think not to belittle the progress the company had already made on that front in terms of being a very early adopter of digital. But we did take what felt quite a tired and jaded retail proposition and modernize it and add some really exciting new bits of capability like the fast track home delivery we're talking about. And so I think that brought it a new life that otherwise it potentially wouldn't have had as it kind of felt more and more out of touch with the ages. But what I would say we never sorted was, but you're still smashing your brains out against Amazon. And in general merchandise, Amazon's very happy making very little profit. And so proud of doing the partnership work with Sainsbury's, which proved the value of that. And I think there was a very strong and robust kind of acquisition business case that kind of close standalone Argos stores because you can put a very small, space efficient concession into a Sainsbury's store and generate the vast majority of the sales and drive customers into the Sainsbury's. So that creates a big step up in profitability when you do that change. But I would say the underlying profitability of that general merchandise business, that gave you a step up, but it didn't step the long-term downwards trend in profitability. And I think if you look at Sainsbury's recent trading announcements, Argos, it just continues to be smashing its brains out against Amazon, and that's a tough fight to fight.
One of the things you guys did, which I was surprised about to read about in the strategy, actually, was actually increased the number of SKUs at the time. Whereas I'd have imagined you'd have narrowed it to sort of compete in certain areas. You sort of went big. What was the sort of thinking behind that at the time?
The interesting thing there is customers want range and choice. And pretending that a commercial buyer can work out what customer wants is dangerous, and kind of, again, back to Amazon, what Amazon does brilliantly is present everything in front of the customer and allow them to choose. And so it isn't that if you offer less range, typically what you get is less sales. So the challenge wasn't one of simplifying the range if you could offer that range without the cost associated of offering it. And so what was clever about Argos's model, and particularly with this hub and spoke operation, was we didn't need expensive space to offer that choice to the customer. We could offer that choice to the customer, kind of a broader range to the customer from the same existing space. So we didn't have the problem of shelves and kind of what products do you delist to put the new products on. And so suddenly, kind of Argos, what we realized was its customer base was across all demographics. And so a lot of that range expansion was trying to bring in brands, and brands that previously wouldn't be interested in listing with Argos because of the brand and what was associated with it. But the transformational journey we'd taken on, repositioning the business, kind of both in terms of reinvigorating the stores, but the kind of the marketing campaigns and everything around it, arguably brought new customers into the business, or at least encouraged those customers that previously only shopped small elements of the range to shop more. And that was all good for the business.
Yeah. I think it's brilliant that the central sort of the hub and spoke thing that was so, so successful, that came from the internal team as well. I think that's a brilliant story. It's so true that the people within the company are often the best route to knowing what's wrong, to diagnosing what's wrong, to fixing what's wrong, if you can harness them, motivate them, and in the right way. Because it must be tricky in those sorts of environments where there has been decline, where you feel embattled, where people are leaving for pastures new because of a downturn. So I think that's brilliant. I really do.
Yeah, there's an exciting story around transformation that does enable you to bring great talent even into a challenged business. And a great shame of it is, once it was bought by Sainsbury's and bought with good logic, and as soon as you started, kind of the model was now kind of run general merchandising more through the Sainsbury's team. This great swathe of, and it became therefore more a kind of business as usual operation. You just saw all this great talent that had been accumulated in Argos kind of move off onto pastures new and fresh. It was just a shame to have seen all this wealth of talent accumulated in one business kind of not be maintained, because it was just no longer challenge for them to want to stay around for.
I think that's often the saddest thing about my previous sort of career as a headhunter, bringing people into those sorts of teams, is you assemble this amazing team and you set them on a path to do something really incredible and they achieve it. And then you watch a new sort of leadership come in and that team sort of slowly disband to the wind, and you're like, oh, that's so good, you know. So I've had that happen a fair few times, so I feel your pain there for sure.
It was just exciting to have been involved in that and surrounded by such great people. And
from that, are there any real big learnings that stand out in your mind from that time that you've taken with you through your other transformations?
I used to say my job is just to bring in bright people so that their reflected glory makes me look good. And there's some work for me to do in that, in terms of providing air cover for them and supporting them. But partly I did great work there was because I managed to bring in some really great people in my team, and having the right people is how to get stuff.
Yeah, right people.
What would your tips be for somebody starting out in a career in change and transformation?
I go back to something John Browett taught me when I kind of started doing this kind of role in Tesco's. And he was explaining how when you feel like everything's being thrown at you and you're kind of in the fight and kind of scared about it, then actually recognize that that means you're in the right place. Don't feel that that means you're actually fighting the fight and you're making stuff happen and people are complaining and challenging and pushing back and all that good stuff. Actually, that means you're probably in the right place doing the right stuff. And driving change is hard. Don't expect it to be easy, but almost if it's feeling like it's hard, then actually that's probably a sign that you're doing the right thing.
It's great advice. Thanks very much for coming to talk to us today, Doug.
Been a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Fascinating to hear all about that.
Really brilliant.